The gospel today comes to us from the book of John, chapter 5. We'll be going from verses 1 to verse 17. After this, there was a festival of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now in Jerusalem, by the sheep gate, there's a pool called in Hebrew Bethzatha, which has five porticos. In these lay many invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man who was there, who had been ill for 38 years, when Jesus saw him lying there and knew he had been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I am making my way, someone else steps down ahead of me." Jesus said to him, "Stand up, take your mat, and walk." At once the man was made well, and he took up his mat and began to walk. Now that day was a Sabbath, so the Jews said to the man who'd been cured, "It is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your mat." But he answered them, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Take up your mat and walk.'" They asked him, "Who is this man who told you, 'Take it up and walk'?" Now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had disappeared in the crowd that was there. Later, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you have been made well. Do not sin anymore, so that nothing worse happens to you." The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. Therefore, the Jews started persecuting Jesus because he was doing such things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father is still working, and I also am working." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Please pray with me. Oh Lord, please help me to do right by your word in these next few minutes. Amen. There's two things that jump out at me from the Gospel of John. One is that it insists very loudly that Jesus Christ is God. He wasn't just a good guy or a great teacher or a mighty prophet. Jesus was and is God, and the gospel comes out swinging on this point from the very first verse. Say it with me if you remember it. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was..." Every speech that Jesus gives about himself, every object lesson in this book points directly to the divinity of Jesus. The other thing that this gospel insists on is that belief in Jesus is what makes you a Christian, not adhering to a specific religious code. The great controversy of the early church, after all, was between those who believed that you had to be an observant Jew in order to be a good Christian, and those who believed that faith in Jesus was enough. Many in the church, especially among the old firm, the people who had actually been with Jesus, men like the Apostle James and sometimes Peter too, felt that faith in Jesus saved you from sin and its penalty of death, but you also needed to keep dietary laws and obey Sabbath observance and be circumcised. And why not? Jesus was a rabbi. All his early followers and the vast majority of his audiences were fellow Jews. And his mission and his message of redemption came to the Jewish people in the neighborhood of Jerusalem first. It seems natural that the law that Jesus followed would have to apply to Jesus' followers. Now, the writer of John sees it differently, and this is the main reason this episode is so rough on what it calls the Jews. When John was written at the turn of the second century by a Jewish convert to Christianity, the early church was really starting to differentiate itself from its parent faith. And as the gospel spread from Jerusalem even to the ends of the earth, more and more Gentiles believed and were baptized, as we just heard about Lydia. She was a Greek merchant and worshiper of God who became the first European convert. And as Christianity spread ever further away from Jerusalem, the differences became more pronounced, especially as church leaders like Paul and Barnabas insisted that one need not adhere to the law, since Christ's grace justifies us before God. And through incidents like Peter's vision of food in Acts 10, which taught him through the metaphor of breaking kosher not to see anyone as unclean. Paul's letter to the Galatians, which predates John by some 50 years or so, forcefully argues that Gentiles do not need to follow the Mosaic law. We ourselves are Jews by birth, yet we know that a person is justified not by the works of the law, but through faith in Jesus Christ, he says in chapter 2. So I don't read the Gospels' largely negative characterization of the Jews as anti-Semitic. I see the Jews here as stand-ins for Jewish Christians who insisted on obeying the law, people who rejected Christ's grace because of their adherence to Judaism and dependence on the law as their justification before God. But I can't help but think that this applies to us as well, especially when we reduce faith in Jesus to our adherence to the forms and rituals of Christianity. In this text, a miracle happens right in front of these Jews, these religious people. A man known to have been paralyzed for decades can now walk around. But they focus on his working during the Jewish day of rest and wind up persecuting the one who healed him. Just as in the account of the blind man being healed in John chapter 9, these religious folk here miss the point, focusing on their religion so hard that they miss the miracles and become more hostile toward Christ. That said, the setup of the encounter between this paralytic man and Jesus comes across kind of like an Iron Age episode of MTV's Punk'd. I mean, Jesus deliberately chooses to heal this man in a very public place at what these religious people would perceive as the worst possible time, on the Sabbath, during a Jewish festival, which the gospel writer, by the way, doesn't bother to specify. The pools of Bethesda were well known at that time as an asclepion, a bath used for medicinal purposes. Evidence suggests that before that, and even after the Romans took it over, it was also used as a Jewish mikveh, or ritual bath, you know, where you'd go to purify yourself on the Sabbath, or during a religious festival. So Jesus goes to one of the few places in the city that's a target-rich environment of people with all kinds of physical disabilities, all wanting to be healed, that would also be chock full of religious Jews who would be very offended at Jesus' breaking of the Sabbath by healing somebody. Jesus knows what will happen. It's as predictable as a tide. Interestingly, the name Bethesda comes from a Hebrew Aramaic Bethesda, which means house of mercy or house of grace. But that word hesda can also mean disgrace. And everybody got the double meaning. It was a place of disgrace because there were so many really sick people, blind, lamed, and paralyzed, says the decidedly non-PC text, that society would just as soon forget and were traditionally seen as being at least partly to blame for their condition. All of whom hope for the divine mercy of healing. But apparently you had to work for that mercy. Now later translators add in an explanatory story about an angel disturbing the waters at the end of verse 3 and into verse 4, as Andrew just talked about. So the first one into the pool after the waters were stirred got healed. As it seems in so much of life, grace there is first come, first serve. It's a reward for being determined and aggressive in a crowd of desperate, forgotten people. It's almost like a simple set of instructions for getting it right. One, watch for stirring of water in pool. Two, be first into pool. I can only imagine that this house of grace turned into a riot of shoving and elbowing as people fought to get that healing when the waters were stirred. So Jesus comes to a sick man who hasn't been able to walk for 38 years, according to the text, lying on his mat, hoping against hope for what amounted to two miracles. First, that somebody would help him down to the pool when there were so many others in competition for the divine favor. And second, for the miracle of that healing itself that could cure him of his disability and help him be normal. And this is a serious thing. In that time and under Jewish law, handicapped people were largely excluded from participating in religious ritual. There was a centuries-old tradition started by King David back in 2 Samuel chapter 5 that, as the contemporary English Bible puts it, only people who could walk and see were allowed in the temple. Because this man couldn't walk, he couldn't participate in temple life, and therefore he was excluded from a lot of Jewish social life. So Jesus didn't just tap somebody at random for this blessing. This is somebody who had been burned by the way the system worked, both in his daily life and in the place he thought he could be healed. And he was resigned to it. You can hear the despair in his voice when he's asked that simple question, "Do you want to get well?" And the poor man's answering is telling, "No one will help me down to the pool. And when I do get there, someone always gets there before me." Apparently, it's not faith he lacks. Otherwise, he'd leave the pool and just go begging. What he's lost is his hope. Things have gone on for the same way for so long in his life that this paralytic man just stays at this house of the so-called house of grace out of inertia. And I can relate. After a while, I guess you just get used to it. Your life kind of gets into a rhythm. You attend all the right meetings, you're on committees, session, board of a nonprofit. Sounds like everything must be okay because you're doing everything right. But Jesus doesn't work like that. Grace here is as personal as a slap in the face. In the midst of all this despair, all that grinding, same old, same old, Jesus gives the man a command to do the impossible. Stand up, take your mat, and walk. And immediately the man was cured, and he obeyed. Jesus singles out this forgotten man and heals him, restoring his health and his hope all at once. No wonder the man jumped up and was off. And the best part was that all the man had to do was obey. Not make a special sacrifice or 1, 2, 3 jump into a certain pool at a prearranged signal. Just obey. Get up and walk. What strikes me is that the crowd of other disabled people in Bethzatha apparently weren't aware of this happening right in their midst. Otherwise, Jesus would have been mobbed. Their attention was still directed at that pool. They were still focused on the hope offered by the traditional method of healing by following the instructions and getting it right. So Jesus was able to fade out into the crowd. Isn't that just so human? Even these people that had been forgotten by society and religion are locked into the same old patterns of, if I do X, I will get mercy. In fact, the only way that anyone knew the man was healed was that he broke the rule of carrying a load on the Sabbath so publicly, since the city was full of observant Jews, none of whom were carrying anything, because Sabbath. I mean, he goes out of the baths carrying his mat. It's only a matter of time until he runs into a group of religious people. And the religious people immediately jump on him about it. Obedience to Jesus apparently includes irritating the religious folk. They're more interested in finding out about Jesus because he told this man to disobey the law than they are about Jesus' healing power. They're so focused on getting the forms of their faith right that they completely miss the miracle that's happened right there in front of them. But all this formerly ostracized man wants to do is get back into the swing of life. It's like he's been in prison for all these years, and now he's out and trying to be a good citizen. So later, when Jesus finds the man in the temple, remember, now he can walk, so he's allowed back in, so mission accomplished. Jesus admonishes him to stop sinning so that nothing worse happens to you. And of course, this healed man goes back and tells the religious people that Jesus healed him, since now he is back in the religious club himself. And later, when Jesus is harassed by said religious people, he confronts them by saying, "My Father works on the Sabbath, and so do I." Funny thing here is that technically, Jesus himself hasn't worked at all. He just talked to a guy and told him to grab his mat and walk. And there's always been an exception in the Talmud for doing good or for saving a life. In fact, Mark chapter 3 relates a similar story where Jesus heals a man's withered hand in a synagogue on the Sabbath and asks if it is lawful or good to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save a life or to kill. God is not limited by Mosaic law. Jesus isn't either. Jesus doesn't let the religious observance stop him from dispensing healing and grace and continues to do God's will in spite of the religious people. But I find it easy to relate to the Jews in this story. Being religious is comforting. It's kind of a supernatural social contract. As long as I do all the right things at all the right times in the right order, God will be happy with me. If I'm doing well, it's because I'm all right with God, because I'm doing what God wants. And if something bad happens or I'm not feeling quite so holy, it's probably my fault. God is displeased with me, so I should change my behavior. And then God will be happy with me, and the cycle starts again. Life is suffering, and religion is all about pain management. Often I think that the pain and the guilt and the shame of all the bad things that I've done and continue to do will go away as long as I appease the religion, go to church, put the right amount of money in the offering plate, hang out at the right meetings or Bible studies or committees. The more I do these things, the happier God will be with me and the more comfortable I'll be. World without end, amen. It's tempting to think that a relationship with God can be that transactional. But from what I read in this gospel, that's not how God works. Grace comes when we least expect it, and usually when we're looking at something else. It can't be earned or bought with good behavior. It is freely given by God through Jesus. If you're only looking for God to move in your life on Sunday, you may well miss out on the grace that God is putting before you on Tuesday. God won't necessarily work in your life in this building on a Sunday or during a prayer meeting. God may choose to work through that guy in the SUV cutting you off on the way to work tomorrow, or through the doctor giving you the news later this week about the blood work you had done, or through your neighbor telling you about their sick child or their broken marriage. God is not limited to our expected religious practice and does not have to meet our expectations when manifesting in our lives. Unfortunately, this may put you in confrontation with the people who are trying to get it right. Like with this man's healing, or the blind man's in chapter 9, or the myriad other healings in Jesus' ministry, there will be blowback from those who look at what you're doing and say, "You're doing it wrong." I find myself falling into that trap all the time, equating time spent volunteering at Build or money put into that offering plate with a good relationship with God, or the quick grace that I offer at the IHOP after I get my coffee, but before that big steak omelet arrives, standing in for honest prayer, or comparing myself either with envy or disdain with others in the church that I see as better or worse at outward piety than I am, or daring to preach a sermon without wearing a suit. But from this reading, the Christian life is not about getting all the bits to hang together just right. So I conclude that if I spend all my time getting my religious ticky boxes correct, I may well miss out on the blessing and grace that is happening right under my nose. So let me encourage us all to be open to what God might be trying to show us and expect this to come from other than sanctioned, unofficial sources. Remember that God's purpose might not be tightly wrapped up in a scriptural bow or come in a Bible study, so don't sweat getting every single procedure right. Just listen for God's grace in your life and be ready to act on it. May it be so.